Wellity, wellity, wellity. We're back from summer hiatus with a new episode of Flicks and Scoops, recorded live at Podfest Berlin 2023, where we even had a screening of the film beforehand. I'm your host, Ash, trying to make some sense of the mess I've made by combining films and ice cream. Each episode, I invite a guest to pick a film, I make a film-inspired ice cream, then we eat the ice cream and talk about the film. This episode was sponsored by Backhouse Projects, a community-focused arts and culture space hosting exhibitions, pop-ups, workshops and more from the heart of Norrköping. Have a look at what's on at backhouseprojects.com or on Instagram at backhouse_projects. Can't bloody believe it this time, it's only Mark Reeder who's on the show. He chose the Srebrenum Globi, or On the Silver Globe. I don't think we actually spoil anything, but just in case, here's a spoiler warning for free. If you haven't seen On the Silver Globe, then it'd probably be nice to try and see it before listening to this episode. And even if you have seen it before, watch it again, or I'll force you to spend an hour reading LinkedIn posts. It's been a while, but we've always time for some zany miscellany, some miscellaneous information about actor Billy Zane. Zany miscellany! In 1999, Zane participated in the first Gumball 3000 rally, driving a 1964 Aston Martin DB5. Enough faffing about, is Flicks and Scoops episode 24.
Now it's time for ice cream.
And you can get it right here.
Just to recap, for those at the back, this is Flicks and Scoops. It's a film and ice cream podcast. So I invite a guest on, ask them to choose a film, and then I make an ice cream inspired by the film. And then we eat the ice cream and talk about the film. My next guest has shared the stage with the likes of Die Totenhosen, The Birthday Club, Die Unbekannten, New Order. But now he's reached peak stage. Welcome to Flicks and Scoops, Mr. Mark Reeder.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Welcome, welcome. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, I've just had my ice cream, so I'm fine.
Not too burnt out from the 3 hour madness.
I can watch this film, you know, any day, actually.
Nice. For any listeners who aren't familiar with Mark, he hails from Manchester in the north of England. And he came to Berlin in the late 70s, where he made quite a cultural name for himself, particularly in the music scene, which he still currently is heavily involved in. And more recently, he was the subject of a movie called B-Movie, which is a personal slice of Berlin history, documenting the West in the 80s. And you became one of the focal points of that film quite inadvertently.
Yeah, it wasn't my intention to make a film about myself. That was somebody else's intention.
And it came about because somebody had asked you for tapes that you had, footage that you'd taken at the
no,
time.
No, they wanted me to do the sound. They wanted me to actually restore the old 7-inch singles that they wanted to use as the soundtrack, so it'd sound good in the cinema. And I was thinking, well, asking what's it about, this film? They said, oh, it's just like, it's kind of like scenes from 80s Berlin set to the music of the time. And I'm thinking, I've got some stuff there. Maybe I can flog it to him for a few quid, you know. So I just thought I'll give him send him a box of tapes and see if he thinks there's anything interesting there that he can use. And then he said, we need to talk. Come to my place. And I'm thinking, what about? And he goes, that's that stuff you sent me. We need to talk. Didn't really go into it any further than that, you know. And I was thinking, crikey, what have I done? What have I sent him? I had no idea. Maybe this film, you know. I had no idea, you know. And it's like, well, what's all this footage? What's all this material? You know, these TV programs that you made and everything. Where's all this from? And I said, well, that's what I've been doing for the, you know, past 10 years. And he just was like, oh, can we see the film as from your perspective, West Berlin, as a perspective of a Brit living in West Berlin and viewing this scene, but also participating in the scene as well. And can you write your story down, basically? So I had to do that. And at the same time, kind of take into consideration, this is not a film about me. This is a film about Berlin, about West Berlin, as seen from my perspective, really. And that's what B-Movie Lust and Sound in West Berlin has become.
Great film, highly recommended. And now your story's also been told in episodical podcast format in Grensgänger.
Grensgänger, yeah.
Yeah, which translates, is it Border Walker? Is that a translation?
Or? Border Crosser, really. But it's not about just the border between East and West. It's about the borders in everyday life, really, you know, like from beginning to end, you know. And my story just, it's like an expanded version of Be Movie in a sense, because it goes right from my childhood until the present day. So it just doesn't just cover West Berlin, it covers all the time that I've been here, yeah, more or less.
You've led a fascinating life. Did ARD get in touch with you to make that, or was it something that, a project that you wanted to do yourself?
It's another one of those pinball machine moments where I'd been involved in this documentary about the Totenhosen playing secret gigs in East Berlin. And, you know, because I instigated that, so they had to have me in this documentary. But at the same time, one of the people from ARD was, well, boss of ARD, or she was, ever she was, or RBB. She was watching this Totenhosen documentary, and she realised that, like, she's known me for you know, best part of like 20 years, you know. And she was like, all the things that you've been, she's only realised when she saw this Totenhosen documentary, that all the things that she knew that I'd done, and the things that she'd seen in B-movie. And she said, was anyone ever thought about doing a story about you? And I'm like, well, no, not really, I don't think. It's not particularly interesting, really. And she was like, well, we should do one. And so this is what became then Grensgänger, the podcast.
And do you get a kick looking back at your life and reminiscing, or has it got to the point where you're just like, God, I wish people would stop asking me about the bloody 80s?
No, not really. I mean, you know, it's something we talk about with my friends all the time, really, in a sense. And it's not like I've been there and done that, and I've come to realise I'm the only person that has ever done that, you know. And I didn't think at the time, you know, I thought that everybody did it. I didn't think my life was particularly of any importance of any kind, because I thought that everybody who was involved in, you know, West Berlin, they went to East Berlin. And then, you know, they didn't though, you know. I wasn't aware that I was the only Westerner ever to make an album in East Germany. You know, I only became aware of that when the wall came down and the people were saying, you know, you're the only person who ever actually got the chance to do this. So I realised that the stations of my life have kind of like, okay, what led up to this point and beyond. You know, I mean, it's like, but I don't really look at it as such. Where I never thought my life was of particular interest to anybody.
I'd disagree. There's an episode in particular that I wanted to bring up. It's called The Smuggler, or Der Schmuggler, to sound like a Bond villain, where it talks about you smuggling cassettes of music from the West to the East. I was wondering if you ever did that with films.
Films are a little bit difficult because in Eastern Europe, the VHS player was cost the price of a car. You know, it's like in Romania, I think there were 3 VHS players. In a few people probably had them in East Berlin, but you couldn't just go to a shop and buy a load of empty VHS tapes. They weren't available, right? So if you had a VHS player, you might have had one VHS that you could record things off the telly on. But it wasn't really the thing. I mean, like, people watched West German television. That was really more of it, you know. I was just really lucky that I had a VHS player and I could record things. I mean, my father would record British television for me and send it over so I could get, you know, I'd be up to date. But a VHS was far more difficult to smuggle into East Germany anyway than a cassette was. But when I started going over into East Berlin with American soldiers, that changed the game completely, because being an American soldier, they could traverse the border without being controlled by the East Germans, which meant illegally meant that I could put things in my friend's car and take them into East Berlin. So one really, you know, then films weren't, it wasn't people wanted to see James Bond films. They actually didn't want to have actually anything like that at all. They were more interested in Teresa Arlovsky porno, because that was a currency. That VHS tape would get your fridge fixed or your central heating fixed. So that was very interesting for them. And that was like some, but they cost a fortune. It wasn't exactly, you could just go to a shop and just buy one for, you know, it was, they're quite expensive, but it was an investment.
You know, operate on like a barter system.
Because you knew that your friends, they'd be able to, you know, get something done for that, you know. It was valuable, and actually in Eastern Europe, the further east you got, the more valuable it became. So, for example, in Romania, Elena Ceausescu had the biggest collection of pornography, right, probably in the whole of Europe, because she, in her mindset, she heard that pornography was very, 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 very valuable. You know, you can get your central heating fixed for that. You know, so she obviously calculated that this was some kind of currency, and so anyone crossing the border who got caught smuggling magazines or VHS tapes or something, then they were immediately confiscated and put into her huge collection of pornography. So when they killed the Ceausescus and they found out that she had this like huge vault full of like 70s pornography, it was quite, you know, so I was quite intrigued by that, you know.
Yeah, I don't know so much about the East German film industry at the time. My understanding is it was kind of on its arse and was getting a lot of Western imports. How do you remember the cinema scene at that time?
In the East? Yeah. Well, I'd only go and watch like communistic kind of movies if I was going to go to the cinema. I hardly ever went in East Berlin. I think I went twice in East Berlin. But most of it, I went in places like Czechoslovakia or in Hungary to see what they had, you know. You'd sit there not understanding a single word because it was all in Hungarian or it's all in Polish or Czech, you know. But the idea was just to see what was on, you know, what kind of films did people go to watch, because they weren't showing Western movies, you know. There's a few Western movies shown in East Berlin, things like, I think it was Wild Style or something like this, about hip-hop scene in New York with Grandmaster Flash, you know. That was the sort of thing that this, anything that showed that you know, some segment of Western life being, you know, downtrodden, yeah, they like that.
Music's obviously of paramount importance for you, but how important would you say film is as a medium for you?
For me, I mean, absolutely vital, you know, for me, you know, I get a lot of inspiration from watching movies. It's always been something that I've had since I've been a little kid, really, you know. It's kind of captivated me through my entire life, and also the music part of movies, you know, the essentiality of having the music part, that was also, I mean, as a little kid, you know, the first thing that I can remember musically is like Doctor Who. Right, being associated with music and film, you know, as Doctor Who. If you hear the original Doctor Who film theme from 1963, it's this electronic soundtrack, you know, that was created by Dealey Derbyshire, and it sounds like out of this world. And as a little kid at the time, you know, I was like 4 or 5, I wasn't aware that it was the first time that I'd ever heard such a thing, right, this science fiction sounding soundtrack. But it was also the first time that anybody ever had ever heard anything like that in the whole of the United Kingdom. No one had ever heard this kind of music before. And from then on, I was kind of like, you know, addicted, really. I mean, as a little kid growing up, watching Gerry Anderson puppet series, like, you know, Fireball, XL5, Thunderbirds, Stingray, Captain Scarlet, they all had really dramatic kind of adult soundtracks to these things. They were really dramatic and sometimes, you know, quirky, funny, almost like circus music sometimes. But that music was always that thing which kind of like captivated me, and it's has done, it does to till today.
I mean, this isn't your first foray into film. I think most recently you did a music video directed.
I did a video for Craig Walker and The Cold for Electric Shoes. I did that, yeah. I got my i8 camera. We wanted to make it look old fashioned, so I got my i8 camera and went out on one Sunday morning. I just filmed him singing around, you know.
And then on the other side of the camera, I don't know if the audience has seen it, but Mark boasts a couple of roles in Necromantic 2 and The Death King. How was the experience of acting for you? Was it something that you were able to throw yourself right into?
Look, I'm not an actor. I was roped into this. I was for The Tortoise King, yeah. I was roped into that because I had bits of uniform that Jürgen Buttgereit needed. And he was like, oh, yeah, you've got that. You've got boots and you've got jodhpurs, you know. So can you kind of borrow them? And then you're in it, you know. And the same thing with Necromantic. I owned a bar and he needed a bar. And I was the only person that could tie a tie. Yeah, and all the people that he knew only ever wore T-shirts. And so I was the only person that he knew that could actually tie a tie, you know. So he's like, oh, I need someone who looks like really spiesig, you know, like some a real kind of like stick in the mud. I want you to be my main, like, male leading actor in this movie. So, okay. So that's what I ended up being in Necromantic 2. But it wasn't like I'd kind of, you know, been an actor. I've been in loads of like bit parts in loads of films that were made here in Berlin, you know. I need someone, and you're in the scene. It's like you, and you come with me. You know, so I've done lots of movies, but I've never really considered myself an actor.
You'd rather be behind the camera.
Yeah, far behind the camera.
So we were lucky enough to just enjoy a screening of Nesrebrnym Globy on the Silver Globe, and apologies to my Polish colleagues for that. Mark restored the soundtrack for the Blu-ray release, which, before we get into the film, I'll just give a quick rundown of the ice cream, which I think most of you have tried. So it's a vegan vanilla and sea salt with a plum swirl. Vegan, as the film is very earthy and primitive, to steal Mark's adjective. A lot of the film takes place by the sea, hence the salt. And I coloured it blue with a spirulina powder, which is made from algae seaweed. And then there's a plum swirl in it, which represents the tone of the blood in the film, and the particular plum is native to Poland and Eastern Europe. Did you like the ice cream?
It was excellent. Really was. It was excellent. It was like, and it, yeah, I was thinking to me when I was eating it, because I only ate it after the film, I was thinking I should have been eating this when the film was on.
So the question on everyone's lips: are you a flicker or a scooper?
Me, I'm probably a scooper.
Really? You take ice cream over films?
Oh, is that what it means?
Yeah, people, they never tell people what it means and get their interpretation of it.
Yeah, because I thought I meant like the way you eat it. Right. No, definitely not. No, yeah. Definitely films over ice cream.
When you do eat ice cream, do you prefer eating it from a cup or a cone?
It depends. I like cones when I'm outside, and I like cups when I'm inside.
And when you do go to an ice cream shop, what's your flavour of choice? What do you usually choose?
Something really boring, usually. Something like chocolate or vanilla.
Chocolate?
But the thing is like, there's vanilla and there's vanilla, right? It's like, not everyone can make a good vanilla ice cream, you know. So if you can't make a good vanilla ice cream, then the rest of it's going to be rubbish.
Agree somewhat. I take quite a hard line on vanilla being a bit of a waste of a flavour, purely for that reason, because it's difficult to get a good one. But I think chocolate's a good baseline for judging an ice cream shop by. So
absolutely,
I'm with you on that one. Is ice cream usually a snack of choice when you go to cinema?
It's probably the only thing that I ever have eaten at cinema. I never eat anything else other than the ice cream.
Well, I grew up with every cinema in the UK having an ice cream parlour in it. I don't know if that was the same for you in Manchester.
Well, when I was growing up in Manchester in the 1960s, it was like, you know, that was it, really, ice cream. In the middle, some girl would come round with a tray round her neck, and she'd like, you'd buy some ice cream at some extortionate price. That was all it was, really. But, you know, you go to the cinema now and you get like food,
people full eating, meals,
eating,
yeah.
Eating, yeah, entire sort of six course meals, you know. It's ridiculous.
I read that, the reason that it started with handing out ice cream at cinemas was because Walls and some other ice cream company got into like a battle who would win the streets of the ice cream territory. And so one of them made the move of taking it into cinemas to sort of try and capture another market.
Good move.
Yeah. Do you go to the cinema often or watch a lot of films?
Well, I used to do, but since the pandemic, I've not done so. Yeah. I used to go to a lot of film premieres and stuff, luckily.
Have you seen the cinema scene change much over time while you've been in?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, thankfully, Berlin's still got a kind of alternative film scene here as well. It's not just all been just become kind of like Cinemaxes as well, you know. But you see the way like the Sony Center cinema and the Sony Center closed, and you know, you get others hopefully opening. And it depends on where, you know, what kind of films you want to see. I mean, like the film we've just watched is not a film that's going to be shown in Cinemax.
You said when we were talking about it, it will never be on Netflix. Why did you choose On the Silver Globe?
Why did I choose On the Silver Globe? Because I find it a fascinating film in more than one way. You know, it's like it's a captivating movie, I think. And kind of, if it depends on how you look at it, really. But I think, you know, it sums up quite a lot of our dilemma today in a lot of ways. And I just love the cinematography of this film. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, so initially I'd asked Mark if we could do B movie.
And I said no.
And immediately he came back and said, hang on, don't I get to choose a film? And that's exactly the type of attitude we're looking for on Flicks and Scoops.
Yeah, it was kind of like you know, like we want to show B movie. Oh, fucking hell, again. You know, like that's what this was about, like the person being interviewed gets to choose a film. And I wanted to choose this film. And I thought, if I can't have this film, then we'll have The Berliner Ballade, because that's another movie that we might do.
I love that you did. Before we'd spoken, I'd had it on good authority that you were a bit of a film buff, so that interaction didn't disappoint. So, yeah, as I mentioned, Mark restored the film soundtrack to On the Silver Globe. How did that all come about that they asked you to
Well, the score, trying to track down the score for this movie was a chore in itself. The film had been, you know, released in like, well, not released, it had been screened for the first time in 1988. And it was like then hidden away, really. And all the elements had been kind of like scattered about. So it was like really hard to find the actual score music for this movie, because Kaczynski, who'd written the score, he had bits, like he had the kind of rocky, psychedelic rock bits and some of the orchestrations, but it didn't have everything. It was scattered around all different places and had to go find out who got what bit where, you know, who's got the industrial parts. Oh, we don't know, you know, it must be try there, you know. So it was a long journey trying to find the actual music elements, of which I've restored for the CD, but it's only for the American version of the film when it's released as a Blu-ray on Mondo Vision, because in England, where, you know, we've just been released on Eureka, they just wanted to have like a visual documentary. They didn't want to have a soundtrack or even a separate soundtrack. And in Germany, they didn't want that either. So it's only going to come out in the USA in the box set of the film.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was everything recorded on? Was it different mediums, like vinyl
tapes,
or cassette?
Tapes. It was recorded on tape, you know. But, yeah, you know, the whole... Krasinski sent me the tapes, and it's like hours of music and stops and starts and him complaining to the orchestra and things, and it's like I thought they were just going to send me the masters, you know, the 2-inch or something, you know, sort of, the quarter inch, and send me the master, and I'd be able to just remaster the master. But it was like, this is just the raw material recorded as is. And Jurafsky, the director of On the Silver Globe, he just took the bits that he needed and said, that's what I want, the rest of it's discarded. So I'm trying to find out, where does that bit occur in this piece of music? It was quite a task, yeah, putting it all together.
And could you just talk us through the process briefly as to how you do that? So did you then re-record the tapes?
No. It was put into the computer and then remastered and you know, enhanced and stuff like that, so that we could find out the frequencies which sound good and kind of balance it out a little bit better, because a lot of it was in mono as well. It wasn't all in stereo, you know, and it was kind of like, okay, the industrial bits were very mono. Yeah, like the kind of ambience that's in the film, where you see it's not actual music, it's just kind of like noises making the music. They were mostly in mono, And it was just like trying to balance it out and kind of like find the bits which appear in the movie and make them into the score, because the score has never been released as an album or anything before. So it's the first time it's ever happened, yeah.
And were you able to approach it from a purely technical standpoint, or was there any part of you that felt, anyway, a little bit funny working on someone else's vision, like, you know, maybe I would have scored that differently, for example?
Not really, no. I mean, you know, I took it as a job to restore this beautiful, crazy soundtrack, you know. It's as the film's a trilogy, so is the music. You've got orchestration, beautiful orchestrations. I wanted to make sure that the orchestra sounded, you know, you heard every sound in the orchestra, you know. So I took great care in making sure that the sweeping strings sounded like, you know, huge. And then you had this psychedelic rock blues sort of thing that was going on in part of the film, you know, that had to also sound like kraut rock, you know, it sounds like that. And then you had the industrial part, which also sounds kind of like Einstürzende under Neubauten, you know. I wanted it all to be able to kind of like have the same chronology. That's what they wanted in America, the chronology of the movie and the chronology of the soundtrack being the same, where each piece appears in the film, it also should appear in the soundtrack so people can follow it. But the best part was that Kozinski, who wrote the film, the music, he didn't have any titles for any of the tracks, right? Like, he said Glob 1, Glob 2. I'm like, what does that mean? Which bit's that? Yeah. So, yeah, it was quite a task.
And do you think you'd want to work on film soundtracks again after this experience?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, it's fun. It was fun because it was compiling something. It's something that's already been released, and just to remaster it, that's not particularly interesting, because there's loads of people who can do that. But to actually, you know, take the separate materials and put them together, that was kind of entertaining, and I felt part of this restoration process for the film, not just the visual restoration, but also the soundtrack's restoration. I think that was, you know, I felt quite proud to have been associated with that, seeing that I'd had kind of a long journey to come to that point, because when I first got to see this film, I'd only ever heard about this mythological film that had been around. I actually got to see it in 1995, I think it was. And what had happened was, a friend of mine, he'd taken mushrooms the night before, and he wanted to watch a game show on television. And he threw a VHS tape into his player and then just kind of like tripped out and forgot about it. And the next day he came to watch his game show, and he's like, what the fuck's this? It's like, this is bonkers movie. Because, oh, that's typical. That's up your street. He gave me the tape, and it didn't say anything on it. He just said, this is for you. And then I saw it. And when the titles come up, it said Nezrebim Globi. I was like, no way. You know, like, he's not recorded all of it, has he? And he's recorded it all, the whole thing onto tape. Yeah. And so I got to see it, and I immediately, like, you know, digitized it as well. And then I just kind of watched it every day for about 3 weeks. It had German subtitles, and because it was shown at some kind of Polish film week on Bayern 3 in West Germany, they'd color corrected the film as well, right? So it's like dead colorful, whereas in the original version of the film, Chavasky really took great care to make sure that the images look kind of like very blue and very kind of like washed out. And that's why the blood looks like purple, like plum, you know. And he'd taken great care to make sure that each part of the trilogy looked different, you know, so it wasn't all bright colours, and, you know, it was like bluish. And but by and by, they'd kind of colour corrected it, thinking, oh, there must be a mistake. Yeah. Right. So, but I got to see it, and then I was like, I thought, you know, everyone must have seen this movie, but apparently no one knew anything about it. And back then, from a record label, MFS, I decided I'd like to release the soundtrack of this film, right? So I tried to track down the soundtrack, and nobody had the soundtrack, of course, because there'd never been one. Nobody knew where all the bits were, you know. Kardar Film, who owned the rights, they were like, oh, I have no idea. You have to ask Kozinski here. Yeah. And until I actually found the guy who'd actually composed the stuff, it took ages, you know, it took ages to find. And then it was all in bits, you know. And then in the end, Cara Film, who owned the rights to the whole thing, they said, "Oh, we want 70,000 euro." I'm like, it's a film soundtrack. It's ridiculous. You, can, you know, I could restore the entire film for that. So and it never actually happened as an MFS release at that point. But, you know, 20 years later, it's kind of, we, you know, we're back there where we started, really.
Yeah, it was a tough enough job for us to find those screening rights to show it. So I don't envy your task of trying to chase down bits and bobs of tapes of the film. So the director made Possession, which was shot and filmed in Berlin, which I imagine you would have seen before this, because yeah, this was halted and everything.
I actually went to the Berlin premiere of Possession when it was released in first release.
Okay, right. Yeah. There was a, I guess there was a huge buzz in the city about it. Yeah. No, really?
Not really, no.
And then upon seeing it, were you then, did you have an inkling of what to expect from this, or did it?
No. Well, I knew that he'd made a science fiction film. I knew when Possession was being screened, and the people who from the Arsenal Kino who kind of organised that, we were talking and said, yeah, he'd made a science fiction film, but the government had closed it down, and they didn't know whether it'd been finished or not and stuff. And at that point, it hadn't. You know, it was in this kind of limbo that he'd started this movie and it had been closed down. It was only after that he actually got to finish it. So our Possession was long gone by that point, you know.
Has the film had an influence on your life at all?
Absolutely, yeah. Totally. It changed a lot of ways I view, you know, just general life. But yeah, sure, it's had an impact, definitely, for sure. You know, it was one of those things like a Tarkovsky film, you know, that kind of, that cinema doesn't have to be Hollywood commerciality, you know. I mean, I've never really been so captivated by such things anyway, really. You know, I think this kind of off-the-wall cinema is far more attractive to me, you know, than watching something like Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain, you know, any of his movies for that matter, yeah. Fando and Liz, you know. These films kind of attract me more than some kind of like Hollywood blockbuster really does, you know. I mean, if you look at Silver Planet on the Silver, you know, on Silver Globe compared to, say, something like Star Wars, they're both at the very at each end of the scale, you know. And I think that anyone who's interested in seeing sort of serious, it's a serious science fiction film with a crazy message, really, and it's not something that you're going to easily understand by watching it once. It's not going to happen.
You said 60 times. And you
I must have seen it at least 60 times. I can't remember. I've lost count how many times I've tried to watch this film and tried to work out what's going on. But then you have to look at it from the perspective of people crash landing on a planet, speaking Polish, and then what have they taken with them, right? What did they take with them out of their culture and their language? And it all gets kind of miggledy-piggledy and mixed up over time, you know, as the generations kind of wash through. It all becomes this kind of like poetry, really. And that's what you see on screen. It's like Shakespeare almost. And it's like, you know, you're thinking, where am I now? And that's what really makes it captivating and intriguing, is the fact that you can't immediately understand what's going on.
No, I think it's a great comparison to draw with Shakespeare, and I think also like operatic and just something very grand and theatrical. Do you think the incompleteness of the film is a help or a hindrance?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm fascinated by the images that Jodorowsky chose to insert for his narrative over what's happening now that you can't see because the cultural minister destroyed a fifth of my film, sort of thing. It's really interesting to see Poland in the 70s and 80s, you know, what Warsaw is like. You know, they're driving down the street and there's like a bus and there's no cars, you know. It's interesting in itself, but I would, you know, I wish I could have seen the film the way Jodorowsky initially envisaged everything, you know, including the bits that were destroyed. I think it would have been quite, it might have made more sense.
Potentially, you know? Not sure. I think
it might not, though.
I dread to think how long it would have been if it had been able to put it.
It's 4 hours.
Right. Well, there you go.
4 hours, because you're on one of the plastic seats sitting for 4 hours.
No, but I agree. I think it does a really, really good job of drawing you in with the theatrics. But then I quite like the cutaways to Warsaw of the 70s because it almost adds a bit of realism.
It's another world, you know, it's the silver globe. What you're watching is another planet. It looks like Earth. It's got water and plants, but it's the silver globe after all, you know. And those segments are almost like respite. It's like, wow, I can take a breather now, you know, like what's next? Yeah. And as the film is in sort of part, it's like each image is like a painting, you know, it's like its own image on itself, you know. It's like,
oh, totally crammed with detail. There was a funny jump cut actually that I forgot about where the actor's screaming and, you know, shouting all these lines, and then it just switches and it's just silent driving down Warsaw. It's almost like comedic jump cut sort of thing. Do you think trying to find any meaning in the film is an act of futility?
No. Really? No, I don't think so. I think it's the way the film kind of develops itself, you know, I just find it captivating. You know, I think it's worth the watch for me.
I don't know what meaning I would extract from it. I think maybe just that he had a very pessimistic view.
Well, it's not. I think it's you know, you can draw a lot of parallels with the things on screen with today's world, really. You know, the way humanity treats itself. We're witnessing it right now, you know, like the way humanity treats itself. And it's kind of like, you know, that's what you get on the screen, is this viciousness and this mentality of madness which drives this viciousness. And I think, you know, you could draw that parallel from the film quite easily, I think.
Totally. Would you say it's any more or less timely than it was previously?
I think it's a timeless film. Entirely film, because the only thing that you have that's kind of like, apart from the segments that you see of Warsaw, you know, the only bit that you actually get to see, which is kind of like sets a bit of is the car chase. Yeah, so that's really the only kind of like partial modernity really in it, you know. Okay, the kind of science fiction-y looking kind of places where the operators are, you see that. But it's timeless in its imagery, I think, you know. I don't think it has a kind of a date stamp of certain, you know. If you watch something like Star Crash, it's very dated, yeah.
Yeah, I think, as you just mentioned, I think there's definitely comparisons to draw on modern day, and yet not to get too bogged down with what's going on right now. But just from a technical standpoint, I think there's stuff that they were doing in that film there that's winning Oscars these days. Like the camera work with the wide angle lenses really made me think of the Revenant that Lubezki was doing. And it's, yeah, it really stands the test of time.
And, well, these things in there like that didn't even exist in the 70s, you know, like the subjective cameras, you know, the kind of like the body cams that you have, like police wear today, you know, that's what the whole thing is based upon, is these body cams that they have in this movie, you know, things like that. It's like lots of like modern day things in there, which kind of like grade it. If you don't know this film was made in 1976 or began in 1976, you probably wouldn't realize, you know, just by watching it, in which year it was made.
Yeah, definitely. I recently rewatched 2001 at the cinema and thought exactly the same about that. I think CGI tends to date pretty quickly these days, whereas everything in that film, set design, costumes, it just felt so real. And I think because of that, then adds to this timelessness of it, in that it doesn't date so quickly. Do you have a favourite scene?
Do I have a favourite scene? Every time I watch it, I have a favourite scene. I think, oh, that's a great scene. That's fantastic. That one bit where the face just appears. But I love like every picture. But yeah, I do. This present viewing here, there is one. There's the expanses of the desert. You know, because it was filmed in like Mongolia. Right.
You were briefly talking about that before because they owed him money or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the Mongolia they owed the Polish government money, so they kind of like said we can do, make your film here. So I think we'll provide you with the infrastructure to make this movie. So they film in Mongolia, the Gobi Desert. Yeah. I'm fascinated by the beginning of the film, actually, when they actually arrive on this planet and you see for the first time where they are, and it's like, where did they film that? You know, Caucasus and places like that. Then you go into the salt mines under Krakow, you know, and then actually Krakow when they're in the street, you know, firing the cannon, and there's all that rubbish on the floor, right? It's like,
oh, it's incredible. And yeah, like you said with the helmet cam, I think that's one scene that stood out for me. It's just, it's so incredibly imaginative and ahead of its time. I mean, this was 50 years ago. I mean, it's thinking about technology that we're seeing now. But the book that it's based on was written by his granduncle.
Grandfather, about like 1908 or something like
right.
that.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know. I haven't read the book. I don't know if.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, but if that technology was in there, then that's just incredibly ahead of his time.
Well, he was quite ahead, as a writer, science fiction writer, he kind of was quite ahead of his time anyway, yeah. But in the story, I believe the story, it takes place on the moon with a very short time span, like 60 years between each, which is why when they actually find the satellite recorder, which has crashed to Earth at the beginning of the movie, they say it's just, you know, the time span is like 60, 70 years. And in reality, it's like, you know, 1,000 years or something.
And which character do you relate to, if any? Or is there anything in the film that particularly resonates?
Marek, because he's Marek and I'm Mark.
I was wondering if you maybe had an affinity for the film because of the history surrounding it, and maybe put you in mind back to the freedom of thought, for example, possibly struck any similarities with East Germany that you saw at the time?
Well, I think that, the, you know, having seen Possession first and seeing what kind of film that was and what it was about, and, you know, the fact that Isabel Adjani portrays two people, and that kind of symbolised Berlin, West Berlin, East Berlin, stuff in the movie. You know, I was kind of intrigued about science fiction-y bit in Possession, right? But I was thinking, I wonder what a science fiction film from Jurassic is going to look like, you know, never knowing. I'd seen another film that he'd made called, it's in German, it's called Nachtblende. It's called something like the Strangest Thing Called Love or something like this, with Romy Schneider. And it was, I'd seen that, but I didn't, that was like pretty kind of normal setting, a, you know, European city sort of thing. Didn't really kind of grab me as much as Possession did, being in Berlin. But with The Silver Globe, it was like, I was intrigued, you know, like what could possibly this film be like, you know, why did the government stop him from making it? I didn't really have much else to go on. I just knew that really there was no kind of history. And I think that the fact that going to Eastern Europe and seeing these places like, you know, Krakow and Poland and Eastern Czechoslovakia and Romania and places like that, you know, I had some kind of association to their kind of lifestyle in a sense, and also the way they made movies, you know, like having seen some of their movies, it's like, wow, you know, Russian cinema was quite impressive, you know, Czech cinema is pretty impressive, and Polish cinema is like, wow, really impressive, you know. And I knew things from the past, like, you know, Polanski's the Canal and stuff like this, and these like war movies from Andrzej Wajda and stuff like that. You know, I was aware of those movies, but, you know, I'd seen those, but I'd not seen anything like this film.
I was wondering also if you maybe found some sort of relation with the director, who was a bit of a provocateur in yourself. And the thing that sprung to mind was your label MFS, which is Mastermind for Success, but the acronym is the same as the Ministry for Staatssicherheit, that you knew would rustle a few feathers.
Well, I didn't really know that it was a kind of like it'd been, you know, booted about in Polish kind of film circles in that time, because it wasn't really known, you know. I mean he went to live in Paris because he married Sophie Marceau. Yeah, he's been in one of his movies, and it was like, that's really all. I didn't really know much. I knew that he'd been back and forth and stuff like that, but I thought it was just because he was Polish, you know, he was able to do that. I didn't realise the situation that he was actually in. And that came later when more history of him was able to be accessible after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Just to finish up, before I'm going to open the floor to any audience questions, do you have a favourite fact or piece of trivia about the film?
About this film?
Mm. I bet you've got a treasure trove.
Well, not really, no. But the person who made the costumes, yeah, she won a prize. It was Jaworski kind of made a kind of like a prize for the person who could design the costumes for the film, and she actually was the one who won, and she made all the costumes for this movie. And they made like at the very beginning of the film, we see the guy on the horse, this figure on the horse. He was actually a horse riding instructor who then got the job of not only riding horses in the film, but also like making the weapons that you see in the film and stuff like this. So everybody was kind of like roped in. They didn't get roped in just for one job. They all had like multiple jobs within the actual production of the film. You know, people who were actually you see in the crowd dancing and stuff like that, they were actually the technicians and the lighting guys and stuff like that.
The one that I got down, you actually briefly mentioned, but most of the copies and screenings before 2016... feature an unnatural tint. To imprint a colour palette desaturated of warm tones, green filters were used for most of the outdoor shooting, and film labs didn't get the message and thought something had gone wrong, so they all tried to rebalance it, so the colour in different countries was all over the shop. Before we finish up, I'm just going to open up to any questions from the audience, if anybody's got any.
Now's your chance. Don't all ask at once.
Don't want to come too close. Hello. yeah, I'd be interested to know why was the film banned, or why was the film stopped, and like what bits were taken out?
Well, all the bits that you see where you see Warsaw in the middle of the film, they were obviously taken out. Apparently, the Minister of Culture at the time, it was his first day on the job, and he decided after looking at the expense of this film, he decided that it had already gone over budget and it wasn't worth finishing it. And so he said, right, it's film stopping. And the people who actually were working on the film, they all wrote to him and said, please don't stop the film. We're halfway there, you know. But he was like, no, that's it. And he kind of had all the costumes and all, you know, the sets and everything destroyed. But Jaworski was a bit cleverer than that, and he managed to like spirit away most of the things and hide them away, and then he kind of carried on making the movie in between, you know, bit by bit, you know. So that's why I said thankfully a trilogy. It was because he was able to do it in that way. That's why it's pretty disjointed. But they actually burnt the negatives that he'd made of the scenes that were that irreplaceable. Yeah. Someone's just somebody's petty, you know, whim. Someone wanted to show I'm in charge, I'm in power. And probably not. Probably just didn't like the fact that Jaworski was able to go to live in Paris and, you know, spend half of his year in Paris and then half of his year in Warsaw. He probably just hated him for that reason, you know. Just like felt he was privileged in some way. And Jaworski's background was quite, you know, was quite a privileged family, if you like. You know, it's like his family were musicians and artists and all kinds, but for the royalty. And in the past, and probably there was a bit of that in there. There was a bit of animosity somewhere. Like, I'm going to show this guy, teach him a lesson, you know. But he didn't give up. He carried on making it. It's like, fuck you.
Other than the composer, did you meet anybody else who worked on the original?
Unfortunately, but up to now, no.
Jaworski died at this point.
Yeah, Jaworski also died, like, you know, quite a few years back, like 2017 or something like that. I never got to meet him, yeah. I was in touch with his son because I tried to track down the elements for this film, but that's about really it, yeah.
Are you familiar with the star rating system of films?
The star rating system?
Yeah.
It could be.
Like out of five?
10.
Cool. Forget everything you know, because on Flicks and Scoops, we rate this film out of scoops. So what would you give on the Silver Globe out of 5 scoops?
6.
There we have it. All right. Thank you so much. Been a pleasure. Cheers, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Fantastic. Big, big thanks to the lovely Mark Reader for humouring my silly daftness. If you want to keep up with Mark, you can find him on Instagram at markreader.mfs. The podcast we spoke about, Grenzgänger, is on ardaudiotech.de. And if you haven't seen it already, then you should absolutely make it a priority to watch B-movie Lust and Sound in West Berlin to get a glimpse of his crazy life. Would mean a lot if you subscribe to the Flicks and Scoops podcast wherever you usually listen to them, and you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter and all the rest at Flicks and Scoops. If you want to try our ice cream, you can frequent Wolf Kino or Sputnik Kino in Berlin, and I'm boring myself with the advertising already, so see you next time.
Now it's time for ice cream.
And you can get it right here.
Ice cream.